right, Jessica, it is so good to have you with me today. I've been really looking forward to this. I've listened to a few of your podcast episodes, and I was blessed. I had a friend of mine share one of your episodes with me because I've been doing a lot of dating stuff, and I think we talk about a lot of similar topics. I think we see the world pretty similarly. So for everyone, this is probably not an episode where we're going to disagree on a ton of different things, but I think you have some really interesting insights, and I'm excited to talk about a few different things today. But first and foremost, thanks for joining me.
I'm so excited. I started listening to your podcast, I think, over COVID. So
that's awesome.
This is pretty cool. It's very full circle.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, it's great to have you. And so I would love, just for people who don't know anything about you, and I just kind of always start this way with guests, is tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what you do now, and any of your faith story you want to share.
So I'm from Mentor, Ohio, which is east of Cleveland. And I just moved back to Cleveland, Ohio. I'm on the west side now. I was raised Protestant, so I'm a Catholic convert, but I actually went to a Catholic high school growing up because my dad was a football coach there and I was kind of sick of public school. So I went to a Catholic high school. And I think, like a lot of people's experience with diocesan Catholic high schools, it kind of turns you off to the faith. It's not presented super well. I found it increasingly liberal, which was really disappointing to me. And so it turned me off to Catholicism. So then I was actually kind of anti-college even at that point, listening to a lot of Glenn Beck, very political, but I was really interested in film and I really wanted to pursue film. So I was going to do a film internship. I did a film internship after high school graduation. I wasn't going to go to college. And then a series of events happened and the 2012 election was happening and I was really passionate about it and kind of spent a lot of time on the film set arguing about that election and politics in general. And so I really felt called to go in a different direction. So then when I came to the point where I discerned, okay, I think I really want to go to DC. I really want to intern. I want to see what this world is like up close. Realized I had to go to college. So then when I was looking for something really conservative and really Christian. Stumbled upon Liberty. I looked at a few schools, but that's really where I felt like God was calling me to. Went there, and that was an interesting experience being immersed in so many different Protestant denominations. Because I was never seriously United Methodist. It was very liberal. I fought with all my Sunday school teachers growing up. So I was never like theologically convicted. It's just where we went. My dad was a lapsed Catholic and my mom was a little bit. Yeah, I think it was just more cultural. His parents are from Europe. And so he grew up Catholic. But I think when him and my mom were dating, you know, he would take her to mass. She didn't really understand what was going on. It was very foreign to her. And then the Catholics that she had known growing up were not serious Catholics. And so she had kind of a bad taste in her mouth, I guess, about it, just lack of fruit. And so she was just going to a Methodist church with my grandma and taking my sister there. And so that's where we ended up. I was baptized and that's where we ended up going. But when I was at Liberty, I was on a search for the true denomination. You know, I was going to all these different churches and, you know, I was with a bunch of Southern Baptists and evangelicals and Calvinists. So I was exposed to a lot. And during that time, I was actually really convicted to be against birth control, even as a Protestant. Oh, and wow. It was due to a few devout Catholic friends, because my mom was always super involved in the pro-life community back home. And so I did have a few devout Catholic friends. And so they initially opened my eyes at a workshop in high school, but I wasn't really sold on it. And so I get to college and there's this documentary called The Birth Control Movie, and it's made by Protestant theologians. And what was so interesting is that they were arguing from this concept that the entire church, all of Christendom, including, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, all Protestants, were against contraception until 1930 when the Anglicans broke. So they were making the argument that if the church thought something for 1900 years, then the burden of proof is on that new idea, that new innovation.
Right.
And I had never thought of that concept because Protestants don't talk about church history. So then I was really convicted. I was like, okay, I see birth control is a moral evil. Catholicism is the only remaining institution that is against this moral evil. So there has to be something true about it. But then I also was thinking about it. I was like, well, then I really should relook at the Reformation, the early church, see if the church thought something for 1500 years. Why do I now assume that that's not true? And so it kind of just started, you know, the wheels turning in my mind. And it took a few years and I ended up interning in DC, and it was weird because I was still looking for a church I liked. It was all based on preference. And I wasn't asking the question of what is true. And so I ended up weirdly going to Saturday vigil masses just because the church was pretty in DC. I felt the most comfortable there. I couldn't find a church I liked. And, you know, just through a series of events and meeting certain people and having certain conversations and then learning more, I ended up, you know, going through a very long RCIA process. I started in Lynchburg, Virginia, when I went back to graduate from Liberty. And then I finished in Cleveland, Ohio. And I actually think I did a year and a half. I came in to the church, I think Christ the King feast day.
Wow.
So yeah, so it was a long process. It was a lot of years in the making. And it's really funny because I look back and when I was going at like, I was 14 when I started high school. It was funny. My mom and my grandma, who are not Catholic, they both said to each other, she's going to end up being Catholic. But it took 10 years. So it was a very long process. But yeah, so I became Catholic. And then, sorry, this is very long. I graduated. I was kind of lost because I had worked for Rand Paul's presidential campaign. He got out of the race very quickly. I didn't really know what I wanted to do after that. And so I was kind of lost for a bit after I graduated. I was really passionate about, you know, alternative women's health, but, you know, I didn't have a medical background. So using the skills that I had, which was writing and speaking, I decided to pursue a journalism fellowship. So then I went back to DC, even though I did not necessarily want to go back. And then I had been there for the last 5 years. And so I just moved back home and started my show, The Base Catholic. It's a podcast and a radio show. So
that's amazing.
That is current. And then I write on the side. So that's currently what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's incredible. And so you were raised in your family to think about politics and be kind of more conservative leaning, or where did that come from?
So I was always super pro-life because of my mom, but right. the political thing, I think that was mostly me, just because I was really interested in what was going on in the world. And I really loved, more than anything, of what was going on, I wanted to know why things were going on. So I was very philosophical minded. And I think I took an interest to politics just because I saw that as like the natural living out of what people fundamentally believe. And so I loved any kind of moral debate or moral dilemma that we would have in class, like those types of conversations, always super drawn to. So even though I loved film and I loved, you know, art in that sense of depicting stories and I love storytelling, I also felt a draw to something that was a little bit more real. And then I kind of stumbled into journalism. Like I started out as a news reporter. I was terrible at news writing. And so then I got moved to video. So then I was a conservative video reporter for a few years. And then I got approached for a television job, did not get that one. But then I got approached to do a radio show. It did not work out with that network. And so now I found a way to kind of do what I'm doing now. So
that's amazing. I love it. And so tell me about what led into The Base Catholic, what that means to you, what your goal is with it, and kind of what inspired you to get started with it.
Yeah. So I got approached by this Catholic radio network that wanted two young women, one maybe married with kids, one, you know, single navigating, you know, career in the dating field. And so I got approached to do this show, could not find a co-host that could devote that much time, because it's a lot of time. It's very time consuming. And so I got approached to do a show. And in that process of developing what I wanted the show to be, you know, I love the concept of BASED because it's anti-woke. So it's our version of woke, just being very radical and extreme with what we believe and thinking about things in a different way. And I felt like there were a lot of conversations that were being had on the right and they were missing a few key points. And so I wanted the show to be a space where we could talk about it and a space for people that maybe aren't, you know, getting Fox News hits. They're not, you know, making the rounds on all the other shows. So I try to find real life people that I think are really, really interesting and have something worth saying. And then I also just, you know, look to thought leaders that I really admire. And then I just really like asking questions and learning more. So that's kind of how the show started. And what I hope to do with it is obviously to grow it in different ways, but you know, I'm a one woman show and it's a lot of work. So we'll see what I can do with it. Right now it's just trying to get an episode out each week is my goal.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I remember the first time I listened to it, I was like, man, you do so much editing. You know, like,
I do. Just,
yeah, it's incredible.
Part of that might be OCD just because I think to myself, okay, if I'm an audience listener, I want to be able to focus on what they're saying. So like, I love taking out filler language, even though I wish AI had a better program to edit that out because it's very time consuming, but I try to do the best I can with it. So
Yeah, it's amazing. I was mind blown. I remember still where I was, like, I was driving to confession one morning and listening to the first episode of yours I listened to. And I was just like, wow, the music, the background cut. The one that I listened to, the first one, when you're interviewing all the women about marriage, it was going like different conversations. And I was like, dude, this is incredible.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. I was like, man, your listeners are much more blessed than those who frequent Seeking Excellence, because they just get my brain dump basically every week that I just try to take the silences out of.
No, you have really high, first of all, you have a very high quality brand. Like, you can tell a lot by someone's graphic.
I appreciate that.
No, your Instagram page is like very legit. That's a goal of mine to get to that level.
That's so funny. Well, I appreciate it so much. Yeah. And that's very cool. I think it's great. I think we need more voices out, you know, sharing the Catholic perspective on things. I found that so many Catholics don't like to get into the kind of current events or the hotter topics, because it just can seem so divisive. This might jump down, honestly, to the last question that I put on the outline, which often happens when I'm interviewing people and have guests on, so I apologize. But this is concept of ideals, right? And so this just made me think of that, because I think so many Catholic speakers, we don't like to talk about ideals. We like to talk about the ones that, like, we all kind of agree on, right? We talk about things like birth control, right? Or IVF, or some of the things that, like, the church has come down with a hard stance on. But some of those things that I've been talking about a little bit more recently, like submission in marriage, or what's another one? Oh, like family life, right? Your most recent episode talking about mom staying home or putting your kids with nannies or in daycare and things like that. And I just find that so many Catholic speakers or Catholic kind of influential people, you have the ones that are willing to talk about anything, but so many are not willing to touch those topics that they feel like are divisive, right? Because they want to be invited places. They want to be at the popular things. You know, I had to sacrifice my desire to be a Sikh speaker this year because I was like, I just have too much I want to talk about. So I guess Sikh's just off the list for me someday. And that's okay. You know, but I've always said that I want to be a Catholic thinker, not a Catholic speaker. And
I like that.
Thank you. I was actually just sharing this with someone who's inviting me to speak next summer at an event. And they were like, what do you kind of mean by that? And I was like, well, I feel like Catholic speakers are those who have, you know, their three to five canned talks that they've given many times, and they've mastered them and they're amazing. And they typically give those same talks over and over again. And I was like, and a Catholic thinker, I think, is somebody who writes or podcasts or any other type of media, right? Where they're constantly reflecting and taking in new ideas, sharing on different topics, stretching their mind in those different ways, right? I think Carrie Gress is a great example of that. You know, she stays, I think, very up to date with what's happening in the culture and speaks to it from her kind of level of expertise, as, you know, focusing on Catholic womanhood and how the things that are happening in the world affect womanhood. And I think that's awesome. And I'm like, that's what I want to be, right? And so I think this, going back to this idea of ideals, so many don't want to share what they think are the ideals for the Catholic family or the way to set up your Catholic life or whatever it is. And Seeking Excellence is all about the ideal. That's all.
Yeah.
But I've had people pushing back recently, saying that they feel like the ideal is divisive or it can be offensive to people. For example, and you probably already know examples. I'm sorry. Now I'm rambling.
No, I like what you're saying,
but
I'm tracking.
That's good. I was like, I feel like I'm all over the place, but I'm going somewhere. But just recently I heard somebody talking about, or I saw a post about, I'm not less Catholic because I don't have X number of kids. And I think that there's always a balance here, right? Where we want to recognize that it is good and God's plan for marriage for us to be open to having a lot of children. God doesn't bless or give everybody that blessing, right? Of 8 kids or 7 kids or 6 kids. Some people only have one, some people have none. And that's okay. But the standard of still being open to children and open to life and being able to see that fruit, right? As somebody who was open to life and they have a big family, we can still recognize the beauty of that without denigrating, in my opinion, you know, a family that has one or two kids. But when you see the culture, in my view, the thing is, if you see the culture is everybody's having one to two kids nowadays.
Yeah.
So let's emphasize the beauty of big families. But in the midst of doing that, you offend some people. So what's your thought kind of just around that in general about ideals, about should we share them? Do you think it's something that is just too divisive? We can't reach the ideals. So is it worth it? What do you think?
I mean, that's exactly something that I had to figure out how to approach in my most recent episode, for example. There are situations that are less than ideal, and God still works in those situations. You know, like, so for example, I had a few friends that were conceived through IVF. Mm-hmm. And anytime I ever talked about IVF, it was really, really hard to talk about around them because they took it personally. And I was trying to always distinguish. I'm just simply saying, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be here. Like 100% no, that's not what I'm saying.
Right.
That would be like saying somebody that was conceived out of wedlock or somebody that was conceived in rape. Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So many, I mean, my family, hello. I mean, there's so many examples where I'm like, okay, nobody was really conceived ideally. That doesn't mean that God doesn't work in those situations, but that also doesn't mean that we don't have a standard that we should all strive to live by. Like there is a best way. And I don't think that that should be offensive. I think it is really hard though to navigate these conversations because I think people, when you talk about a standard, if they can't meet it or they didn't come from a situation that met it, they immediately feel offended. When in reality, mm-hmm. you're not attacking them personally. You're stating a rule that should be what is strived to be, you know, like it doesn't have to be a personal situation.
Right. And so many priests, I think, face this from the pulpit because they get so much negative feedback, but it's kind of like the story. I always use the example of a priest gives his one pro-life homily for the year and somebody comes up pissed afterwards because they brought their friend to mass who's been away from the church for a long time. And that woman had an abortion and now she doesn't want to come to mass anymore. And it's like, dude has to preach about this. He can't pull the entire audience, right? And I've had the IVF conversation. I'll never forget. Somebody reached out. I was so mad. This was like one of the most things. I've got a lot of negative feedback. And this one, for some reason, really pissed me off. Was somebody saying, hey, I was conceived through IVF. Like, it's really important. You should give disclaimers. And I'm like, I'm so sick of giving disclaimers. Have some common sense and don't be so sensitive. I have never once, I was conceived out of wedlock. I raised my hand, but obviously people can't see the video, but raised my hand when you were talking about that. And I'm like, I have never once sat in a chastity talk and been like, I shouldn't be alive. You know, like my life is meaningless. Why? Because it's like, it's obvious that that's not what the point of this talk is. It's acknowledging that certain things are sinful. And I'm always saying that we should just, the ideals are for young people mainly, right? They're for people of all ages, but I think my main purpose of sharing them is for young people who can still avoid getting into those situations, right? And I think that's what your last podcast episode about, you know, stay-at-home moms and nannies, daycare, all that is for, right? Let teenage women, young women, young married couples hear this and try to set up their lives where they don't buy a $1 million house when they're 27.
Yeah.
So that they can live in their means, right? And if they want to stay home, if the wife wants to stay home, she can. And create a lifestyle that's going to set that up for success, you know?
Well, and another difficult thing about even having that episode is, you know, my friends might agree with me and that's maybe how they're deciding to raise their children. But then you also risk offending the fact that their mom put them in daycare and that they're fine. Yep. They're not messed up. You know what I mean? So you're never going to, and that's the reality. You can't write, say, or do anything if you're afraid of offending someone because you're inevitably going to offend somebody.
Yeah.
But the intention is, again, never personally attacking people and their situations. But it's like, if we can't talk about having standards or having ideals, I guess we're going to just accept relativism because that's ultimately what it comes down to.
And that's what I thought that was interesting in some of your guests that you had on that episode, kind of talking about that, right? Like the ultimate answer, I feel like, and especially if you work in that industry, you don't want to offend anybody. But I remember hearing one of them, I think it was the second one, that said, like, it just depends. It's up to everybody's situation and what they want out of life. And I think you're kind of flipping the question of nannying and daycare and all that on, you know, taking it away from, well, it just depends on what the mom wants out of life to what's best for the child.
Yeah.
Is that's where you shift from what's, you know, works best. That's where you shift from relativism to ideals, right? To universal truth. And I think that's such a critical shift in all of these questions, right? In all of these different things, because we all are going to fall short of different ideals. But what I find is that the people who are most triggered and upset, and the nannying thing is such an important example of this, it's those situations where it feels innate, right? Where you kind of have this instinct that says, I shouldn't be doing X, Y, or Z, right? It's kind of written on conscience. It's kind of a violation of natural reason. Those are the ones that typically get the most upset when you start to talk about how they're not living in the ideal. Even though you're not talking about them directly, you don't know their whole story, you're not pointing at, you know, dropping names, still it's the moms who suppress that feeling they had while on maternity leave to stay home and not go back to work. They're going to be the ones that are most upset when they hear about, oh, that would have been the right decision and I didn't make it, even though I thought about it and I felt it, you know?
Yeah, because nobody wants to feel that. No one wants to feel accountable. They don't want to feel shame. And it's weird to me because if you accept the premise that we're all sinful and that we all fall short of God's standard, I mean, calling that out in somebody, it doesn't mean that I'm, you know, guilt free and that I'm sinless. You know, like we all have our areas right. where we're not meeting the ideal. So it doesn't have to be a, you know, I'm holier than thou because I say this. I mean, again, I'm not saying that, but like I should still say it.
Absolutely.
That's at least how I thought.
So tell me about, you mentioned in that last episode about how you had kind of a shift of, you know, going from I'm going to be super career focused and having all these goals and ambitions of being in DC to, you know, kind of shifting to you want to be if you do have kids, you know, you want to be a stay-at-home mother. Like, what was that kind of transition like? Because I think most women, from my experience, especially that have been kind of conditioned in today's kind of feminist world and just career, you know, obsessed world, have that shift or at least start to ask that question when they have children. So what was it like for you that kind of sparked that change of mind in your life?
I mean, I've always been super passionate about a whole host of things. So I think for me, you know, I had that drive, I had that ambition, but I also always was I was always a romantic and I always wanted to get married and have kids, but I was so obsessed with this idea of like, well, I want both and I don't want to have to sacrifice one or the other. And I would always constantly, you know, like I have a mother who is so anti-women working that our fights
really?
In college, yeah, are, and it's hilarious because, I mean, she was a school bus driver. She worked the most minimal hours ever, 2 hours in the morning for a morning run, 2 hours in the afternoon for an afternoon run. You know, but she was a single mom with my older sister. So my perspective growing up is just so realistic of what it is like that she really has shaped me. And it's funny because when you're in college, you have no idea what the working world is like. And so you have all these ideals and you're all excited about life. And then I feel like once you enter, give women about a year or two, you know, those rose-colored glasses come off real fast. And so for me, it only took that, you know, it only took the first big girl job to kind of see up close and personal what, you know, these aspirations really look like. And so I became disillusioned and I realized it wasn't the deepest desire I had. Like the deepest desire I had was to get married and have kids and to be present and to ultimately be my mom. And so, and just watching her be so obsessed with me and my sister, to be honest, it, you know, like it used to kind of annoy me. Like she'd sit at like a swim meet practice and, or like a swim team practice. And I'd be like, why are you, like, I felt like Rachel McAdams, a Mean Girl. I was like, why are you so obsessed with me? But looking back, it's like, she was just very enthralled and involved with our lives. And, you know, she's our biggest fan, but you know, she also is our critic. And I just feel like every child deserves that because I think it's such a, it's a perfect picture mirroring God's love. You know, like if I see how much my mom loves me, could only imagine how much God loves me. And if you don't have a parent that is plugged in and there, that's, I feel heartbroken for those kids because I had a mom that was just so plugged in. So I think you just kind of grow and mature. And then you also just see the reality of the jobs and you're like, okay, so I'm going to sacrifice what most people find the ultimate happiness in for this. And like, you know, I was in DC, like I saw powerful people running for office. I saw, you know, media moguls, you know, business people. I worked for a doctor. Like I worked for a whole host of people that were at the top of their field. And I just never looked at their life and thought everything that they sacrificed to get to that point was worth it. I was like, no,
right.
Like just looks exhausting. So yeah, I think just disillusionment, honestly, I think is like the key. And I think until you are in the real world and you witness that, you're not going to necessarily know that. So
yeah. And it's so interesting. I'm doing a book club for CEX's supporters on the Screwtape Letters right now. And it's just it's one of my favorite books in the world. But one of my favorite things is just how we can go through the same experiences or generally the same experiences and come out with such different takeaways. And so I think it's beautiful that you kind of came to that conclusion because some people just get more into that, right? They just get like, they just kind of suppress it or ignore it. And they've been so kind of brainwashed to think like, no, this is what I'm made for. I'm made to succeed and be a career woman and prove that women can do X, Y, or Z. That I think they just kind of forget. They ignore it. They ignore the ugliness of it. They ignore the fact that it's not fulfilling. They take more medicine, right? Because they're depressed or anxious or whatever it is. And so we just kind of drug our way or distract our way through these kind of painful realizations of how dry and empty a lot of these worldly pursuits can be. But it's so funny to me now that I'm in that, we always talk about, we've kind of been going through these phases, right? Where like you kind of get out of college, and then there's like, for me, I didn't have a lot of friends that got married super young. So I had like more weddings when I was like 25 to 27. And now it's like a lot of people are, all my friends, most of my groomsmen had kids. We got married a year and a half ago. And I think in the last year, the last like 15 months, like almost all of my groomsmen who are married have had a child.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, like five of us, I think, if you include us. And so we've had a lot of kids, and now we're getting some rounds of like people getting pregnant with their second and things like that. And so it's kind of funny seeing like peers and stuff, and not just them, but like, you know, all my college friends, high school, and people I know on Facebook, Instagram. Like, it's interesting seeing people go through it now. And, you know, you hear the statistics of, when you make over, it's like 75 to 90K. When you get over that, there's not really a huge change in your quality of life, right?
I heard it's 60.
60, yeah.
Yeah.
And it probably depends where you live, right? So LA is different than Oklahoma, but you think about, you know, whatever the range is, most dual income families with college grads are making much more than that. And it's interesting to see the dilemma and the debate between should the mother keep working or should she stay home? And I'm just shocked by, I think it's hard. And maybe you, even in your research or talking with them, what do you think is the answer for that a lot of women give if they ask what's best for the child? How do they decide that mom working is what's best for the child? Or do you think they just don't even ask that question?
Well, that's a good question. But I actually, something that you said, you mentioned finding fulfillment. And I kind of relate it to the ego, because I think I made this observation when I was like 9 years old. I was like very observant, actually very young. And we were having a debate with like my uncle and my cousin. And I said something to the effect of like, my mom would be the same person whether she had her measly job or not. And I think going through a period of not having a career right away, like I struggled to get a job after college. I was really lost. I didn't know what to do. I think going through that experience, I think what God taught me in that, because I had severe anxiety about it, I think what he taught me is, you're the same person whether you have a job or not, whether you're doing something great or not, you're the same person. And I think a lot of people's identity gets wrapped up in their job. And I think that's the issue. If whether you're a woman or a man, if your identity is wrapped up in, you know, how influential you are, how powerful you are, how much money you're making, if it's wrapped up in all the status stuff, okay, well then, yeah, you're going to need that job. You're going to feel like you really need that. But I think if you're free of that, then it's kind of like, okay, well, is this adding peace to my life or is this adding chaos? Like, is this money really helping my family or is this really more just for me? And like, do I really have the time to put into this, or is it causing, again, more stress for like other people in my life? You know, like, is this more for my ego or is this, you know, harming my relationships? Like, no one asks those questions. Yep. And so going back to your question about, what was it again? Asking.
Yeah, the question is this, what's best for the child? Do you think women are asking that and like kind of manufacturing a different answer than you and I would come up with? Or do you think they're just not asking the question?
I think it's hard for our generation because I think adolescence has been extended for so long that I think we all kind of still have that mentality of, well, I'm a kid and I have dreams. And no one really recognizes the shift that takes place, that like once you get married and have kids, it's not about you anymore. It's about the family unit. It's about your child. Like, the baton has now been passed. I'm not saying you're old and going to the retirement home and you can't do anything, but the focus can't be about you. And I would assume, especially since everyone is for the most part, generally, culturally getting married later, like, don't you get to a point where you're kind of sick of living for yourself? Like, you actually want to live for someone else.
Yeah.
Like, I'm at that point. I know a lot of people that are at that point. So I guess that's why it's weird to me for people to still kind of be obsessed with themselves and what they want to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, but you're bringing in this child. And it's especially interesting for women because, you know, there is a biological component that is supposed to kick in. And, you know, there was I referenced a researcher in my podcast episode, and she was talking about, again, it comes back to attachment. If you did not have a secure attachment to your mother, then you're likely as a mother not going to, you're probably going to sever those bonds. Like, you're not going to have a secure attachment to your baby. And a lot of postpartum depression comes from, you know, your relationship with your own mother. And so I think a lot of this is just generational. And I think after a few generations of women in the workforce, I think we are going to see those effects and how that relates relationally.
Yeah. man, so much there. I think the generational aspect of it is so real. I just recorded, or I just released last week, my first part of my episode with the Ortegas, who do the Pre-Canaan with the Pope podcast. And we talked about, they both came from divorced homes. I came from a divorced family. And so we were talking about, like, how do you, you know, develop a Catholic family after that? And the so many people are afraid of marriage. And you do have a lot of people who are afraid of being parents as well, mothers and fathers, because they're like, I don't want to pass on to my kids what I received. And not enough people are like, how can I receive healing that I need to not do that? Right.
Yeah.
And that's where you have to, you have fears and anxieties. It's good to go find solutions, right? This all, I think, is a big part of the, even what you talked about with just like this obsession with fulfillment and feelings over duty and responsibility. To me, it's just, I point so much back to, you know, feminism and just the feminization of our society and our culture and even the church, where it's like things are so feelings-based and duty and responsibility are typically, you know, thought of as more masculine virtues. And I think when we silence that, when we silence and feminize even the men to say, okay, if I have this problem, if I have anxiety or worries or fears or wounds, like, come up with a solution, right? I mean, it's like the stereotypical conversation or difference between men and women, right? When they're venting, a husband and wife, is that the wife a lot of times just wants to be listened to and the husband wants to present a problem to find a solution. You know, like, that's why I bring up the crap that I'm struggling with or thinking about. But one thing you just said there that actually was like pretty powerful for me was, I'm thinking about my own life now. I remember a time that I used to really complain about and mourn was like, I was like 19 or 20. And it felt like I had this shift where instead of my mom and my grandparents, especially those three people in my life, but it seemed like in general, people stopped living for me and expected me to live for them. Mm. And I really mourned that because it was like so abrupt and such a shift. And there was a lot of different things that we could get into of how that worked between my parents' marriage ending and like other things. And I think that what's interesting is it was a good thing that I was underprepared for, right? Because nobody had really taught me about being a man. I had not really been initiated into manhood. So I was kind of unprepared for the responsibility of it. And it just kind of came out of nowhere. There was no like transition, right? Like you're supposed to have like this initiation into manhood where you expect that you're going to live for other people and you're going to be a producer and serve the community, right? And protect and provide and all of that. But it was, now that I think about it, when you were talking, I was like, man, but that was a good thing. That was something that was supposed to happen, but I was unprepared for, you know?
Well, you might have been a little young though, you know, like, yes, that should happen. Like, it's not all about you, but at the same time, when you're a kid, I think it should be about you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think as a kid, some people have to deal with it much earlier than I, and I did have some aspects of that when I was like 10, 11, 12, but it really shifted. I remember in like my late teen years, which I think now that I should have been ready for, but was not ready for because my dad was largely absent through some of those pivotal years. But I hope, you know, in our son's life that he'll be ready when he's 15, 16, that we'll start to gradually transition that, right? That responsibility won't be like a night and day difference, but we'll start to say, hey, you have to start living for other people now, taking responsibility for others, caring more about other people than you do about yourself, right? Like you're not a child anymore.
Yeah.
But that is such a beautiful transition. But I think a lot of people don't make it. And I think so many people just stay in that place because you hear it. This is one of the saddest things I remember from a divorced adult children of divorce healing retreat last fall. And one of the things they talked about hearing that I never really thought about before, but they'll be like, don't you want your parents to be happy? Isn't it good that your parents are happy? Even though this is, and it's like the kid's supposed to be like, no, I don't care about my parents being happy, right? I care about being raised in an ordered home and a good family. Like that's what I care about. You can't destroy the family and make up for that with my parents being happy, but that's a smaller version of that happens when it's like the kid's crying or like in the example of your podcast, they're calling the nanny mom and they're confused and mad when mom comes home and sad when the nanny leaves. It's like, oh, but aren't you glad mommy's fulfilled at work?
Well, my friend Maria, so she's a child of divorce and she's a therapist, Catholic therapist specifically. And she was a former Focus missionary. So she's just she's great at talking and she understands a lot about humans and different situations. And one thing that she had said was that there's something really distressing as a child when your parent is putting things on you. They're looking for that emotional support. They're looking for you to fulfill something. And there's something about that just like you reject it because you want them to be your rock. You don't want to have to be their rock.
Exactly.
And I think there's a lot of broken marriages and relationships where they are depending on the kids for way too much, and the kids are not meant to handle that.
Yep. Yeah. It's just a flipping of the relationship. And so you do always, in a sense, want to have your parents as you can go to and you can rely on. And there's something beautiful about that, I think, especially a father, right? Because you really rely on your father for strength, the mother for comfort. And so when you lose one of those or both of those, especially in a short period of time, it's very shocking. And I can speak from my own experience, it's very difficult, right? I didn't ever lose my mother's comfort, but was kind of expected from my mom as she was going through a divorce and things like that to be more comforting. That, and not just be a place of comfort, right? So it was kind of just much more reciprocal than I think a typical parent and child relationship is. And we've grown a lot and been healed from a lot of that as well. But I think divorce introduces a lot of disorder, right? So you're going to have that. But I think this is another small way that disorder can be introduced. And then another thing that I've talked about kind of going along with this too is, and I would love to hear your thoughts on, do you have any general perspective on stay-at-home dads? So some people will say, okay, it sounds like you've thought, but some people say, okay, you know, mom makes the most money and it is best for a parent to raise the child. So what do you think if dad stays home then, if dad chooses to stay home with the kids?
Okay, so this is, I had a massive conversion in all the ways, not just faith-related, but politically, philosophically, everything. So when I was graduating college, I was obsessed with that stupid book, Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg.
Oh, I'm unfamiliar.
So she has a book about how women need to lean in, how they're being basically left behind in the workforce, how they have to kind of just like, you know, really advocate for themselves. So I'm reading this book, I'm highlighting the whole thing. It's really good. And it's so funny because so like at that time, my mindset was kind of, yeah, like if I, you know, can have it all and I can have both, I would really love a husband that's super supportive and can kind of help out. And like, you know, I don't know if I necessarily wanted a stay-at-home dad, but I was kind of a little bit more open to the idea, a little bit more open to the concept. A few years later, I'm just like, no. Like there, because you know what it is?
It totally shifted.
Okay, so here's the thing. Women want a family man. You do want a man who is plugged in to you and the kids. You don't want a guy that's checked out. Like you want somebody that's very in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you also want him to be the man. You want him to provide. You want him to go to work. The idea of me getting up and going to work and he's at home and he gets to be with our kids, that pisses me off. Like I can't accept that. So, and I also just, there's a part of me that now sees it as like an innate laziness because it's just an abdication of his role and it's a role reversal. And it's here's the thing, like women can fill the role when they need to. There are plenty of single moms that have to fill both roles. But if there is a man, why would you want to? Like, that's what it comes down to. If there's a guy around, why would I want to fill that role? Yeah. So I just think like you can be a very strong woman, but I think strong women are actually only attracted to stronger men. So I don't know what the relationship dynamic is of a woman who is comfortable with a guy taking on her role, taking on his role. It's just a very weird situation. And also I was thinking about it as a kid, love my father. You know, I'm a daddy's girl, but my mom is like, she's home. She's your first apartment. She really is.
That's right.
And you can't function, you can't live without her to such a higher degree. So I think I've also recognized the difference between a mother and a father. Like you want a present father, but I mean, your mother is your life source. Like it's just a very different dynamic.
Yeah, I think just the reality that you need your mother in that first year, physically and biologically, so much differently than you need your father, right? And I think that nature.
But like even in life, it's like who's the chatter? You know, in relationships, typically it's typically your mom. Like you're going to her for like all of the emotional needs, and she just has to be so much more mentally present. And there, you know.
Yeah. And it just, I think all of it comes back to this, I think is kind of the core, what I always say is kind of the core lie of feminism. And I think, which is why I struggle with so many Catholic women today who will say, oh, I'm a Catholic feminist or whatever, is I think the core lie of feminism that has always kind of been there from the beginning is that men and women are the same. And it takes it from, I think it kind of goes under the guise and Catholic feminism can kind of try to go under the guise of, oh, we're just saying they're equal in dignity. It's like, okay, they are equal in dignity. You know, children and adults are equal in dignity, right? Like the infirm, like people who are vegetables are equal in dignity because they're still humans. but it doesn't mean that they're the same, right? It doesn't mean that their rights, their responsibilities, their roles in society are the same. And I think the lie of feminism has always been that men and women are the same. And so you see this kind of seeping into the Catholic world through things like stay-at-home dads or moms working in different aspects like that, where it's just kind of like, well, it doesn't really make a difference, right? It's just a parent is a parent, and the dad can do this, and mom can do this, and we don't have to kind of follow these rigid traditional roles that that have no place in society anymore. And you start to see the consequences of these things, and you're like, well, maybe there was something to that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's always exceptions throughout history. So, like, I am a huge Queen Victoria fan, and it's an interesting dynamic because she was very much a traditional wife to Albert. She included submission in their wedding vows, even though I think a lot of people wanted her to not, because they didn't want this foreign prince, you know, to be superior, like not superior, but an authority in the marriage.
Yeah.
But she wanted a traditional Christian marriage. So she included those in her vows. So she was, you know, mother to 9 children, you know, submissive wife to Prince Albert, but she also led England in like its most glorious period of history. And so, but you saw Albert kind of step in and fill the role to support her in that mission, but he did it in a very masculine way. So like, I do think that there is, I think the Catholic outlook on this, you know, is open to those exceptions, but I think there's like a general rule that works for most people. So I'm not here to say like, you know, a hard, fast rule, but I do think generally speaking, yeah, like most women are not Queen Victoria. Like that's just the reality. Like this was kind of being said during the Justice Amy Coney Barrett hearings.
Yeah.
You know, all of these women were like, you know, yes, you know, Amy Coney Barrett is a great example. I was like, Amy Coney Barrett is insanely smart and she is rare. Like most women, I'm sorry, most women cannot have 7 kids and be on the Supreme Court. If it works for their family, Jesse, I wrote about him for the American Conservative. I think he seems like a really cool guy. I would love to be a fly on the wall in that dynamic. You know, that's a great situation, but that's a rare situation. Like I'm kind of horrified because I'm like, most women are not going to love their jobs and they're not going to be in a powerful position like that. That's just a very unique situation.
Yeah. It's kind of like watching a young black boy want to be LeBron James or Lil Wayne. You know, it's like, it's like, hey man, maybe stay in school, you know,
and choose
to be a lawyer or something like that, because maybe do something a little bit more realistic. Because yeah, you do have these exceptions and exceptional women and things like that. And God, I'm sure, calls certain women like those two that you just named to be, you know, more present in the world and more influential. But I think that generally speaking, yeah, you know, this is what the ideal is for, right? This is kind of the general rule and you have exceptions. But I think it's bad when we flip and make the exceptions the general rule. This is the same complaint, right, that we have with like extraordinary ministers at mass or things like that, that certain people will be like, it's supposed to be the exception and we've made it the rule. And we've seen that similarly in that case, right, where you see like the belief in the Eucharist drop down. It's like, this is what starts to happen, right? When we start to make exceptions the rule, then you start to have typically bad consequences. But enough about all of that. Now I want to ask you, Jessica, because I haven't had, I'm trying to think of the last single woman I've had on to talk about anything dating, and it's been a while.
Oh, God.
So tell me, let's transition a little bit there. So you did this wonderful episode that I enjoyed, where you interviewed, and tell me about the kind of setup for that. Did you interview, was it 5 women, 10 women? I think they were all kind of, you I think specifically were looking for women who are older that were single. Is that correct? And the one I was talking about?
Yeah. So it's called, I think it was Ignore the Culture Warriors, Get Married When God Wants You to Get Married. I can't remember how many women I interviewed for that one segment of Crame's Corner, but, and honestly, it was kind of just generally for people because I do know a lot of single men. Yeah. So it wasn't specifically ordered towards women, but at the same time, I did kind of tailor it towards women because I was noticing a lot of conservative male commentators constantly, what's a way to put it? Like going off, popping off about some of these, you know, single women that, you know, are obviously not super excited about their state in life on TikTok or, you know, Instagram reels.
Yeah.
And so I was seeing all these reaction videos and I was like, okay, this is not helpful. They're also, they don't get it. They're missing the picture here. So I wanted to do an episode that spoke to that. And Emily Stimson Chapman is just amazing. I could listen to her talk about anything. So yeah, it was a really fun episode to do. But yeah, I asked a lot of women, and especially the question was, you know, what would you have told your younger self if you knew you were going to be single this long? Like, how would you have lived differently? Because I do think there's this expectation in Catholic culture, especially if you go to a Ring by Spring school, that, you know, you want to get married, therefore you're going to get married when you want to get married. And that's just not the case. And so I was like, okay, you know, we're constantly in the culture talking about, okay, women, like, you know, focus on getting married, focus on it. And I was like, okay, well, I know a lot of women who focused on it didn't necessarily make it happen,
yeah, it didn't work,
you know, in their timeline. So the reality was kind of like, okay, let's flip the script. And like, how would we live differently if we, like, if you knew you're going to be single this long, you know, instead of waiting in bated breath for your husband to just show up, you know, would you have traveled more? Would you have picked a different career? You know, how would you have spent your time? You know, how would you have had the outlook towards dating? Like, how would it have been different, you know? And yeah, it was just really interesting to hear that because I don't think that's talked about enough.
Yeah. And so what was kind of the general consensus, you know, from your perspective on traveling more, choosing a different career and things like that? Because I think this is something that I want to say from the women. I just recently released a podcast on dating, a long solo one that I recorded many months ago and I thought was too hot to release. And I almost never released it. And then I did. And I didn't get nearly as much negative feedback as I thought.
Yeah, I need to listen to this. Okay.
But the place where I probably got the most pushback from my single, like from our single female friends, I don't really have a lot of, you know, close, I don't have close single female friends now as a married man, but a lot of our single female friends that we know, their pushback was on, I said about kind of setting up your life that's more conducive to dating. And what I mean by that is, I was like, I wouldn't suggest to a 30-year-old single woman, if a friend of ours came up and she was 30 and single and she was like, hey, I could go be Ben Shapiro's personal assistant. Do you think I should do it? And I would travel with him and do all this different stuff and work for him basically, you know, 12 hours a day or whatever. My answer would be no, I don't think that that's a great idea for you, even though it could be very fulfilling. It sounds like the most awesome job in the world, right? Or one of, because I
love
Ben
Shapiro,
him.
Really?
My favorite would be Patrick Bet David. He's my personal favorite, currently my personal hero. But so let's say Patrick Bet David, you get to be PBD's personal assistant. It's like, should I go do that? And I'm like, no, probably not, because I don't think that traveling that often, being gone, having to work that often is going to be conducive to dating. But that doesn't mean that I think you should just be like a nanny, right? Or like a preschool teacher, or like something that is also, you know, giving you the maximum amount of free time. But I'm like, you still have to, I think, make some sacrifices in your life. Just like, I mean, I got out of the Army right before I found Emily. I don't know if maybe I could have done it while I was still in. But even when I was in the military, I was like, you know what? This is really tough on, tough on family life. Like, I don't even like dating. I was always dating long distance and things like that. I was like, I don't like this. So it wasn't the main reason I got out, but it definitely influenced it. And so for me, I'm like, you should set up your life that is somewhat conducive. If you're working 15 hours a day, 12 hours a day, 10 hours a day, every day, you know, and not able to go do things and have a life, then I think that at least you should prepare to be single longer than you might be otherwise. What do you think about that?
Those are interesting. Okay. So here's the thing. For example, I had friends who, okay, does this sound familiar? Stuck around their Catholic college town a little bit longer to just be in the vicinity of young Catholic men. Mm-hmm. I had friends who were teachers, you know, or nurses, like these very like traditionally feminine jobs. And yeah, I think they got to a point though, where they're like, okay, but this is not enough for me to actually live on. I have to increase what I'm making to pay back loans, you know, to just be at this point in my life financially better off. And so I think some of the decisions were made on that. I know for me, I mean, not that I ever had the money to travel to Europe, even though I am aching and dying to go. But I think for a long time, I was like, okay, but my ideal is I really want to go on these adventures with my person. And then I was kind of at this point where I was like, okay, but I really should be living these years out. Like, what if I don't have, what if I meet someone and I don't have time or the means or the, you know, it's not feasible to go at that point. Like, am I going to miss out on stuff that I could have been doing during these years? So I think there was a shift in mentality of, it's going to happen when God wants it to happen. I can't will it to happen. So I need to live my life while I wait. And I think some people, for example, not that I would take like a personal assistant job or, you know, want to maybe travel that much, but I think some people would take that job because they're thinking, oh, I'm going to be meeting tons of people that I wouldn't normally be meeting. You know, maybe I'm going to meet conservative people. Maybe I'm going to meet Christian people. I think other people would think, oh, I'm out and about. I'm going to be like, you know, in different areas. Maybe there is somebody that's like not in my town. And so I think some people would look at it in a different way. And I think it ultimately is going to come down to discernment of where God wants you, because you're not going to miss God's will for your life if you're actually doing his will for your life. And I think a lot of women make decisions out of fear because they do want to put themselves in a position to meet somebody. But it's almost like, I think when you want something, like it never happens. So I think in some ways, I think what I learned from,
like
from interviewing...
fireflies.
Yeah, it's like, I think from interviewing these... Yeah, from interviewing these women, I think like what I realized is you hit a point where you're like, okay, God, I give up. Like I'm releasing my hands. This is up to you. I can't make it happen. And I think there's like a peace that comes when people do that. And so that was something that I thought was really interesting is it's weird. It's like the older you get, the more at peace you get versus when you're young and you're like freaking out. You're like, I need to meet someone now. Like I have this, you know, I have this timeline. I have to meet someone now so I can get engaged by then and married by then and have a kid by then. But then it's almost like you look back and you're like, oh, if I would have known, like you were so young, just breathe and relax and enjoy where you're at, you know, cause you end up worrying all those years away and it didn't really do anything for you. It didn't benefit you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think that's a good kind of exception or different perspective on the executive assistant kind of scenario or
example. I get what you're saying. It's like, what are your priorities in life? You know, even as a single person, I am not a careerist. I do not want to live, breathe, and die for a job.
Yeah.
You know, I do really love my show and I am putting a lot of time and work into it because this is my livelihood. But yeah, if you were to give me two choices on a silver platter, like... I'm not going to pass up, you know, a family for a job. So,
yes, which I think is really important. But I think a lot of men get kind of nervous when they see somebody who is telling them.
Hot that, topic.
Yeah, I think this is reasonable that I think a lot of men get nervous when they see a woman that they like who seems to be very career focused or working a lot, because I think that it's an unrealistic expectation that women have that men should just assume and believe a woman when she says, oh, but when we get married and have kids, I'll change.
Okay, so I've had so many conversations with guy friends about this. They will be talking, oh, I met this girl. Oh, but she travels a lot. Oh, she's, you know, getting a new job. Oh, she's really in her career. I want to shake them. And I'm like, she's single. Until you are going to provide for her.
I don't think we agree on this. This is great.
Oh
we
my disagree gosh. On
this. We found it.
It drives me crazy because I'm like, what do you want her to do? Like, you're not... providing for her. She has to provide for herself. Like
I think that's similar to looking at a guy who maybe goes out too much with his friends or just things like
and you're you think gonna that, equate those two. Are you serious?
I think both of them, if that's they insane. Continued, would be detracting away from family life. And I think that the reason why I don't think it's crazy is because I think that you can see that a lot of women get married. Everything we talked about at the beginning. How many women get married and feel that call, they feel the pull to stay home. And to be more family oriented, and then they just suppress it and ignore it. They can't take the idea of disappointing their jobs. They, you know, still have college debt to pay off. They want to maintain a certain standard of living. They feel like they worked really hard to get to where they are, and they don't want to let go of it. I think it's a huge gamble. It's a huge risk for a guy to be like, I'll take your word for it, and you're just going to stop. I think it's a risk and a gamble. That what I think is unfair about it. This is where I probably get the most worked up, is I've seen so many women over the last 5 years, especially of my life, dump or not want to go on a second or third date with a man who can't have deep enough theological conversations, who wasn't an ex-seminarian, or like dumb and silly reasons. They just didn't feel right anymore. They just weren't excited about it anymore. Things that couldn't grow and change. And then it's like on the other side, they could be full blown 90 miles an hour career focused women. And then men are just supposed to be like, oh, I'll take your word for it that you're going to change. But then when you have women who find good men that they're dating, they leave it because, oh, well, he just wasn't that fun on the first date.
Okay.
That's where I feel like there's this double standard of like, we don't have to give men the opportunity to grow and change and become the man that we want them to be. But women are just... we just always have to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they're going to become the Blessed Virgin Mary after the wedding rings on.
Okay, well, here's my thought, though.
I think this is fun.
I think it comes down to, though, you have to get to know someone and you have to know their heart. You know, like, I'm a very blunt person. I am sure people have over...
That.
Yeah, I'm sure people overheard me say something and they're thinking I am one way in their head. But then it's like the people that know me in my actual life, like they know my heart. So they know what I mean by how I say something. But, you know, maybe I'm a little blunt, but they're like, oh, but I know her heart. It's that's how she is. I think there's a nuance to a person that you will only know by getting to know them, by dating them. You can't, I mean, it's kind of, I don't even like Jane Austen, and I'm going to have an episode where this English professor tries to, you know, get me interested in Jane Austen. I don't know if it's going to work, but I don't like Jane Austen. But go back to Pride and Prejudice. Like, the whole premise of the story is that first impressions are not always accurate. And mm-hmm. I think we do need to give people the benefit of the doubt, male and female. So I agree. There could be a double standard there. And I would call the girls out for that. I mean, an ex-seminarian, deep theological conversations. I don't know. Maybe that's super important. Maybe that's a deal breaker. That could be fair. But there are plenty of girls where that's not a deal breaker. So I don't think that the guy, I think he'll be fine, is what I'm saying.
But I do think
that, like, if you're a woman and you're having to support yourself, I do think if a guy thinks, oh, she has a job, well, what is she supposed to have? Like,
yeah, no, I think it's good to work, you know, when you're not married. I think that's totally fine. Where I struggle with is sometimes I think it can get a little, like, even thinking about like the Europe trip or like traveling Europe and things like that. Like, to me, it just depends on the situation that you're in. I think I would view it as bad if somebody came to me and they were like, hey, I've always wanted to go to Europe. I'm 27 and single. And my first question would probably be, do you have student loan debt? Because if you're going to drop 5K, 10K on a Euro trip and you got 20K student loan debt, like, to me, that's probably a bad move. Just, I mean, like, I would.
You don't even
man,
have to have debt if you can't afford it. It's expensive.
You shouldn't,
I mean,
do it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So these are the kind of things, though, that I feel like aren't discussed about, because, you know, we've been seeing this increase on social media in girl math, and I have witnessed girl math the last 18 months of my life being married up close and personal, more than I ever had in my entire life. And so most of it's
we hate
joking,
math. I don't know if
Emily,
you know if you
Emily
knew that.
Emily digs some girl math. She really hates math. Yeah, we were doing something earlier today and she was counting months on her fingers. It was so funny. But yeah, so I think that some of those things where it's like, let's just rein it in and recognize, like, we don't need to travel the world to be happy. It can be fun. It can be good. But I think sometimes it's like, yeah, we have to have this like movie of a life where it's like sometimes, like, whole, especially as Catholics, that's where I sometimes struggle with it, is like this idea we have to provide for ourselves and that means we have to make 100K. It's just like, it's good to like live a humble lifestyle, find something that you enjoy doing, but maybe that you don't love. But I always tell people this. I came up with this kind of framework for picking a career when I was in the Army. I was getting out of the Army, excuse me. And so I came up with four different categories. One was control of your time. So like if you had to work 60 hours a week, right, that would be low on the scale. If you got to work 30 hours a week and make 100K, right, that'd be really high on the scale. Salary, time, control, where I got to live, and my job satisfaction. And I said the goal is to have like an average of an 8. Because if you have a 10 in salary, you probably have a 2 or a 3 in time.
Mm.
And vice versa, right? Yeah. Like there was like certain youth ministry jobs where it's like, yeah, I would, you know, work 30 hours a week, but I would only make 40K. And so you get to decide, you know, kind of the scale. And that's what I'm generally trying to work at here, is like, for single women, I don't think going for a 10 for salary is considered providing for yourself, or, you know, just kind of keeping busy until you find your spouse. Like, I think if that gives you a 1 on time, I think that's a bad trade. I think it's a bad trade for anyone. When I was a single man getting out of the Army, I was like, I don't want to have no time. You know, like, I don't want to not have friends and not have fun and be able to do other things and podcasts or whatever it was that I felt called to, right? Volunteer work and play basketball and different things like that. So I just think that it's not good for anybody to do that. So I think that when your life is being really dominated by work, then it can be detracting on.
Yeah. And
it is silly for men to be like, oh, she's working, I'm not dating her. I'll give you that.
Well, I also think like there is a travel obsession with our culture, mm-hmm. and our generation specifically. I mean, here's the thing. I am an architect. I'm an architect snob. Like, I absolutely I think it's a love affair. I really do love old buildings. So there is a part of me that I want to see those cathedrals. I want to see the historic, you know, Western Catholicism in Europe. So like I especially want to see it before it's all gone, if you know what I mean. So I really want to go. But I also know that I think part of it is everybody is just like itching for something. And I think a lot of it is they want to have a family. But again, it's like when they don't have that person, they're trying to fill those that void in their life with something, whether it is their job, whether it is travel, whether it is, you know, this really distracting social life. You know, yeah, I think it's great to have a social life, but I also, you know, I came from DC. It's really easy to probably be okay being 30 something and single there because a lot of other people are single. It's very transient. There's always events. There's always this illusion that like there's new people coming, a new influx, you're going to meet someone new. So I think even that can be a detriment to building a marriage culture, to building a family culture. And so, I mean, I think it could go the same for guys. Cause like, I do think a lot of guys that are like very career oriented, you know, is this because you want to build something for your future family to provide, or is this to inflate your own ego? Because you want a better sense of self, you know, and I think you said that. So
yeah, and discernment is really important. You really hit on that well, that no matter who you are, what your situation, man or woman, you should be discerning and praying about what God wants you to do. But I think, and that's the other thing that I would say is really important in this as well, is I've just seen so many things, like relationships expose people in ways that not much else does, and marriage is the most exposing, right? And I think the other thing that I try to challenge people on, and this gets really tricky because this gets into some ideal stuff where people who shouldn't need to hear this or don't need to hear this hear it and they start to like second guess themselves and gets kind of scrupulous. But there is a fair number of people out there, both men and women, I think, that it's not just about that you'll get married on God's timing. God sometimes does want you to get your ish together a little bit before he's going to give you a son or daughter to have for life, right? Yeah. And so that was a big thing for me. I've even come up to this. I've been trying to be very transparent with people where I feel like very clearly in prayer recently, the Lord has told me, Nathan, seeking excellence has been stagnant for so long because you have been stagnant with me for so long. And I don't think that's only true in my ministry life, in my work or whatever it is. I think that's, I remember feeling that way when I was like, God, why can't I find a good Catholic woman to marry? None of the good Catholic women would date me. He's like, cause you're not ready for it yet. He's like, you need to keep like getting your life together. He's like, bro, you're still a mess. And I was, if I'm being totally honest. And so I think a lot of times what I've seen in some of these women who can be very judgmental in some of these small little details or whatever, it's like, sometimes it is that need for that interior life. That, and not always, this is why I don't want like to trip, you know, men or women out who are overthinking that. But a lot of times it can be a maturity thing or a spiritual life thing where it's like really submitting and allowing that interior life to be built up and those virtues to be built up within you. One, it fills that hole that you're talking about that you're looking for another person to fill. Usually that God has the capacity to fill that, right? That traveling or working or anything else cannot, especially if it's the God, you know, it's the hole. You can still have the hole for your spouse, but I think it feels a little bit different when your God hole is filled. Then you know, the other holes tend to, you know, usually overflows into any other empty areas of your life, and you don't have that same kind of anxiety or any negative feelings about it, right? You can still long for good things. You can still long for it and dream about it. But I think the like true negative feelings about it, I think something is off there spiritually a lot of times when that happens. Not always, but I think oftentimes that when we are getting truly depressed or truly anxious about it, there could be some spiritual aspects that are missing there too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all that to say, my last question for you, Jessica, this has been great. My last question for you, because you talked about this a little bit about the cathedrals being gone. What is your level of optimism? For the future of the country, future of the world, society. Maybe you would give it like a 1 to 10. What do you think?
Well, I'm in Ohio and I don't know if you saw the news, but we have a constitutional right now to abortion in our state. We legalized pot and minors can get sex changes without parental consent. So you are catching me on a day where I'm not very optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, I flip back and forth. You know, obviously as Catholics, like we have hope in a world beyond this world. So if we're heaven bound and heaven focused, you know, you can't really get too down in the dumps because I think at this point, especially I don't know about you, but like, I'm just super detached from this world. Like, I just, I'm kind of ready for Jesus to come back personally. You know, I just, I'm kind of over it.
Yeah.
But I think we have to do what we can with what we have. And so there is still that, there's still that, you know, desire to see the change that you can affect in other people's lives. And I think it's really just going to come down to that personal level of change, you know, being the rock or being the person that God wants me to be for my family, being that in my friendships, you know, being that to whatever extent in my community, in whatever, to whatever extent in the world that you have influence. So like I try to be positive, but to be honest, I'm kind of a cynic. Like I think I've just gotten, and it doesn't mean that I don't have those ideals that we talked about earlier. I do think it's important to maintain standards and ideals, but I also, I'm not naive, you know, and I think a lot of Catholics sometimes fall into naivete, and I'm realistic. Like I just know how people are. I know how the world is. And so I don't expect too much. So I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. I say the same thing. I think I'm maybe cautiously optimistic, but I don't even think I would say that. I'm probably somewhere in between. Because I just, I always like will point out when somebody will say, yeah, but like all the people we disagree with, right? Like they're not having kids or, you know, LGBTQ community, like they're not reproducing.
Oh, that's a whole topic that we could talk about.
Yeah. We'll say that for the next one. We'll do a part two someday. But I'm like, yeah, but these people are the best in the world at creating converts, right? Like, I mean, progressives, they, because they have the entire education system, it's like, they're just converting our kids. And they're just making our, not our kids, you know, like, I don't worry about it for my own children, but like your general Catholic kids that are out there in public schools or really woke Catholic schools, they're just being brainwashed into that side. And so it's like, it doesn't even matter if, unless we start to return to, you know, the beauty, truth, beauty, and goodness of our faith and start to share that with more people. And most importantly, live it out to the fullest extent that we can ourselves, we're not going to see much change. And so the inspiring thing to me is that we need saints. And so I think the Lord wants them. And so if we're willing to participate and cooperate, I think he wants to make us those saints, which is a good thing.
Wasn't there, who said it? I don't know who said this, but there was a quote that said, I think it's Fulton Sheen, where he goes, arguments have never won people over. It is the personal witness of your life, something to that effect. Mm. And I think that's so true, because I think I've met a few people in my life who, I think it's the hypocrisy of a Christian that had turned them off from the faith. But when they witness somebody that's really willing to die to themselves in the ways that they don't want to die to themselves, like that's a powerful witness. And I think those are the ways in which we might have effect and that God can use.
For sure. Absolutely. I love it. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. Yeah, this was amazing. So you want to tell people, just again, remind them your podcast and where they can follow you and stuff like that.
Yeah. So Apple and Spotify, the Based Catholic and Based B-A-S-E-D with a D, the Based Catholic. And I will have a public Instagram at some point. I had to, Instagram would not let me make a separate page for my podcast. So I had to change my handle. So I'm in the process of changing that. But yeah, eventually Instagram, you can follow me. And then on Twitter at JustKramer1776.
I love it. Well, thank you again. This was awesome. And yeah, I look forward to having you back on someday.
Yeah, that would be fun. I'm totally up for that.